Sunny skies at 82 degrees. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. And we begin with this. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says the rule of law must be followed when it comes to lawful immigration. As expected, Sessions today made the following announcement regarding the Deferred Action Childhood Arrivals Policy, also known as DACA.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
Now, here in Georgia, more than 24,000 have been approved for the DACA program to date. That's according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. We'll have more on this later in the program. But now on to some big news regarding the state's largest transit agency, MARTA. But first, let's go back to the last time MARTA General Manager and CEO Keith Parker was on Closer Look. Parker was asked how long he wanted the job.
Well, I plan to be here for a while longer. My board extended the my contract last year. So we're pleased with the way things are going. One of the cool things about what's happening at MARTA right now is that we are one of the more popular transit authorities in the nation right now. So that makes recruiting a lot easier for me when I go out and try to add two members of my team. And I have thoroughly enjoyed the time we've had in Atlanta. We've got a lot more to do.
Well, everything must come to an end. Today in a press release, it was announced General Manager and CEO Keith Parker is stepping down after nearly 5 years of service. Parker will join Goodwill of North Georgia as its president and CEO this fall. According to the statement from MARTA Chairman Robbie Ash, the board will vote to approve an interim general manager in an upcoming session and will launch a national search for a permanent chief executive. And Ash went on to say, as chief executive, Parker helped to usher in a new day for MARTA's customer service, fiscal responsibility, and service expansion. He leaves MARTA stronger and healthier than ever before. And a programming note, Chairman Robbie Ash will join me tomorrow on Closer Look. We're back in a moment. And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. As always, I'm Rose Scott. Earlier this summer, we spoke to residents of the Park Villa apartment homes located in the city of Brookhaven. The property had been sold to a developer, and now plans for luxury townhomes are underway. That left residents like Melinda Ward unsure about where to find housing.
The problem is all the apartments on Beaufort Highway are fully capacity. There's nothing for rent, so it's pushing people outward. And when you got a daughter still in school, they've been with the same friends, it's kind of hard. I mean, even now, I found a place, but coming up with the money, I mean, I've been without work, my back went out, so I've spent all my resources to keep my head above water. Mm-hmm. So even now, I got to pay the money, but I don't know where it's going to come from.
Now, Ward has since relocated to the Tucker area, and many other residents of the complex simply had to leave. The Park Villa Apartments homes are close to Beaufort Highway, and like a lot of areas in the Atlanta region, new development has popped up, is under construction, or is on the way. What does this mean for Beaufort Highway Corridor? That's something Ryan Gravel is looking into. You know the name, and whether he likes it or not, Gravel is considered the visionary behind the Beltline. He's now teaming up with Georgia Tech School of Design to focus on Beaufort Highway. So guess what? Ryan Gravel is back, and he joins me in studio. Welcome, as always.
Thanks, Rose. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Beltline, Beaufort Highway, just sticking with the B's for now?
Yeah, for now. Maybe move on a little bit later.
You know, we've had you on this program a few times now to talk about urban planning and obviously the Beltline. You've turned your attention to Beaufort Highway. Why?
Well, Beaufort Highway is really exciting. You know, I think, you know, related to your earlier comment about the apartments there and the changes that are coming there, you know, I think it's an illustration. Beaufort Highway is a great illustration about how change is coming to this region, whether we do anything about it or not. And so people can point fingers at the Beltline Trail and transit and all that. But the changes are coming anyway, and we need tools to address them. Beaufort Highway is special to a lot of people for a lot of reasons. The cultural ethnic diversity really unmatched in Atlanta, in metropolitan Atlanta, and a lot of people really focused on trying to protect that diversity. And seeing that change come is frightening for a lot of folks, not only the people who are there. So we are looking for ideas about how to address those challenges.
Before we get or dig deeper into that, I want to talk about something. I don't know if you and I have really ever really dug into, and that's that G word, gentrification. Mm-hmm. I've had people say, you know what, it's not necessarily a bad word all the time. Mm-hmm. It's about the execution around mm-hmm. gentrification. Mm-hmm. How do you define gentrification, Ryan?
To be honest with you, I try to avoid the word. Mm-hmm. It means too many things to too many people, and it's just a loaded word. Mm-hmm. And unless, you know, for people who want to say that there's a good side to gentrification, you know, it's just not worth the argument. You know, let's just narrow in more specifically to the particular issues. You know, is it economic displacement that we're talking about? Then that's one set of solutions. If it's cultural displacement, that's kind of different, mm-hmm. related but different. And, you know, there are good things about revitalization of neighborhoods, of course.
Which is probably a better word,
you think?
It's
a different word. Well, and it's less general. It's kind of, I think we just have to learn to be more specific with our language.
So when you think about Buford Highway now, that corridor, and what it represents in terms of its cultural heritage, mm-hmm. what comes to mind? How do you define that then?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the things that we will explore in the class. I grew up in Chambly. My dad, when he came out of the Air Force, was flying little Cessnas out of PEK. We went shopping at the mall that's now Plaza Fiesta. Mm-hmm. Went shopping at the Home Depot outside of 285 before it was, you know, when it was one of the very first ones. And, you know, at that time, Buford Highway was very different from what it is now. Mm-hmm. I think the point is that it's evolving always, a culturally evolving corridor, and nobody's, I don't think, asking to protect it and, you know, in some museum kind of quality, but mostly just to make sure that it remains. I think the interest is in protecting it as a landing pad for people who are coming to this country and are looking for opportunity. And Buford Highway has a special kind of character in that regard, you know, innovation, adaptation. People can find community with people who speak their language and have similar cultural values and that kind of stuff so that they can look for opportunity in America.
Let's talk about this partnership with Georgia Tech and its School of Design. Mm-hmm. How did all this come about?
Well, I'm interested in generating ideas about the future of cities, and so I created a new little nonprofit called Generator. Mm-hmm. We're not quite up and running. We're sort of up and running. We got a startup grant from MailChimp, and part of what we're doing with that is teaching this class called Generator Workshop. It's a curriculum for teaching ideas, how to generate ideas, and how to refine and develop ideas so that you're thoughtful about who they impact and what the outcomes would be, narrative, visualization, political strategy about how to implement ideas. And so the class is kind of neutral to the subject matter. We would teach it in other schools in other disciplines. We're starting in the School of Design at Georgia Tech and focused on Buford Highway as a geography for mostly because it's just a really rich environment for these kinds of challenges, you know, and discussion.
When you talk about generating ideas for a project, mm-hmm. like the right. revitalization of Buford Highway, right. do you feel like that hasn't really been happening in certain parts of Atlanta for other areas that have been redevelop or currently mm-hmm. under new development? Do you think that's been missing?
Well, I think, yeah, I think we do a lot in this region that's just sort of inertia, you know, where there's mm-hmm. it's not trying to achieve any particular kind of goal. We're just following what we doing those with things we always did or letting things happen to us without playing an active role in deciding what that future looks like. I think it's important to point out that Buford Highway has a plan. It has a master plan, and you can go to buhimasterplan.com and check it out. We're not trying to create a plan for Buford Highway. Mm-hmm. We're just looking at what they've done in that plan, talking with people in communities, and coming up with ideas that would help people manage the changes that are coming. And the ideas are really broad in what that might mean. So we'll see what the students come up with. Tonight is class 3 out of a semester full of classes. So we're not quite actually talking about those ideas yet. We'll start tonight. But they could be everything from a bus stop to a after school program or a business incubator, something like that. It doesn't have to be about growth and development and affordability, although I suspect that some of the ideas will.
Will there be key shareholders that need to be a part of this workshop that you'll bring in, for example, mayors whose cities are along the Buford Highway corridor?
Sure. We're working with We Love Buhai, Marion Liu, who's mm-hmm. a superstar on Buford Highway and deservedly so, is really making change out there, making people feel making the communities and the businesses there part of that change, or, you know, trying to work toward that end. And so depending on what the students come up with, we will then, she will help us sort of partner them with the people that they need to be talking to. So for example, if they do an after school program, we're gonna get connected with people working in the schools mm-hmm. along the corridor. If it's more about parks and public space, we'll find those. If it's transit, we'll talk to not only to MARTA, but some of the private sector transit operators there.
You mentioned managed plans, how people involved can manage plans, but as you know, when new development comes in, I mean, let's just be really clear, they're there to make money.
Sure.
So as new development is taking place, will this workshop teach the students, or will it also encourage reaching out and sort of embracing that new development? And even before they break ground, mm-hmm. what are your plans here? How can we be part of the community? What are your plans for the community? Will you reach out to those entities?
Well, I don't want to be misleading and suggest that we're doing a plan for the quarter, because we're not. And so some of the students' ideas might have to do with those mm-hmm. kinds of topics, and we'll dive into that as much as we need to. If it's meeting with the community, sure. Meeting with the different jurisdictions, absolutely. I think that this course, though, the Generator Workshop, we could... These are design students. So mm-hmm. we've got a robotics student, they're industrial design. We've got a bunch of architects, some urban planners, some civil engineers. So they're focused on the kinds of ideas that are applicable to their kind of work. And we're okay. making sure that those projects consider equity and affordability and climate resiliency and all kinds of other topics. But they will define what their ideas are. We could similarly hope to do this curriculum in a different kind of school. Mm-hmm. So if we were doing it in a business school or finance, you know, school, then those students would be looking at it financial systems to unlock a lot of the problems.
So partnering with the design school was direct. I mean, that was what you wanted to do first, because you just mentioned business and finance. So partnering with this school, school design seemed to be more appropriate for now. You're talking about the future future of a city.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think finance drives a lot of the decisions, and you know, designers can talk all we want about warm and fuzzy ideas about all this stuff, but the financial systems are stacked against people on Beaufort Highway and everybody else in Atlanta, and that's really the real problem. Is that it's something we're starting with design because, you know, we're beta testing this. I don't know what we're doing, you know,
and that's a great quote.
Anybody who says that they know what they're doing or what the future looks like for any of this is just, you know, trying to sell a book or something, you know.
Well, we've had people sit right there where you are that have told me they have the solution for affordable house.
That's pretty hilarious. I think that we do. I think that the people do have answers, actually. And the problem is that the answers are not politically palatable, or we're not listening to them. And so part of the idea for what that answer is has to include the political strategy. How are you going to get it passed? How are you going to get people to listen to you? How are you going to get people to care? Because right now, you can go to the housing forum. You can talk. There's housing experts all over Atlanta. They mm-hmm. know what we need to do in Beaufort Highway and downtown Atlanta, wherever we're talking about. The problem is not the lack of solutions. The problem is the lack of ideas about how we're going to get people to care about it sufficiently so that we vote for it, that we pay for it. You know, affordable housing, there's lots of stuff that we can do for free, but there's going to have to be some revenue sources. This is not easy. It's not a silver bullet. It's not a single thing. It's a way of life. It's a different way of thinking about it. And if we, as I've said on this program before, if mm-hmm. we are going to face this tsunami that's coming at us, then we better get serious about it. And that's everybody. And so we're not going to be able to do that without ideas. And so Generator Workshop is about getting, not only developing ideas, mm-hmm. but getting a new generation of thinkers, young people, to start thinking about ideas, not being burdened by politics or budgets, but able to think big about what the future needs. And then let's figure out ways to do that.
Ryan Gravel, why is this so passionate for you? Even going back to the Beltline. This is your calling, so to speak. All of this, correct?
Yeah, you know, I'm a lucky person in that I found what I am really good at and what I really enjoy and feel passionate about, and I get to do it, you know. And I know that not everybody gets to do that, and so that makes me feel a sense of obligation about really enjoying it and doubling down on it. And I'm having a blast. So,
do you get tired of the calls and questions about the Beltline because you sort of removed yourself from this whole project, so to speak.
No, come on. I'm not. I left the board, and yeah. But you know, I've quit the Beltline before. That wasn't the first. That wasn't the first time. You know, but I didn't. I'm not leaving the project. I'm still involved. I'm on the board of the Partnership for Southern Equity. Mm-hmm. They're part of the leading, looking at ways to address equity on the Beltline and other parts of the region. So,
how do you feel that's going, Ryan?
I think that, you know, since that last year when Nathaniel and I left the board of the Beltline Partnership, that mm-hmm. the dialogue around it has really amplified quite a bit. And I'm not saying it's because we left, but certainly the things that have happened over the last year, the change in leadership that we're seeing right now with Atlanta Beltline Inc. is all around these issues. We're headed into a mayoral election. Again, this is politics. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we, the people of Atlanta, speak up and say, what we want, then we can get it.
As it relates to Buford Highway, you've had two classes so far.
Yep.
What's it been like?
It's fun. You know, the first class, for one, the class booked up in an hour, so that's great. We have 18 students. The first one, we talked about ideas, what the class was about, and they mm-hmm. kind of stared at me like, this guy's crazy. The second one, we went out to Buford Highway and met Marion Liu and Buila Buhai. We ate dinner at... I'm going to blank on the name of the place
okay.
we went. But we ate dinner with the students out there and talked about the community. They had tonight, they will share their first impressions of the quarter. Most of them have already been out there. They're already pretty well versed in these topics. So we're excited to hear what they think about it.
How do you gauge or assess, I don't want to say the success of these workshops with exchange of ideas, mm-hmm. but at the end, when it's over, how do you assess what just took place this semester?
Well, one thing is that the students will be invited to submit their ideas into what we're calling the Library of Ideas. So Generator, the
kind of like what you did some years ago with the Beltline.
Yeah, yeah. Generator, the nonprofit, will be a platform for ideas. We'll have a physical platform in a restaurant and bar that will open in hopefully next summer. We have a mobile platform. We just bought a 1978 Ford Econoline van lined with orange shag carpet. That is our mobile platform. We will also, of course, have a digital platform. So we'll be launching our website in a few weeks, and it'll have in there a way to submit ideas, but also a way to see ideas, share ideas, particularly for people who don't have a voice or a platform to speak on. So we're, you know, we're just getting kind of started, but and if anybody wants to help fund that, we're welcome to more support. We could really use it, but you know, excited about that. So the ideas will live on and be a place that that people can come back and check out.
Generator Workshop, that's the name of it?
That's the course, and then Generator is the name of the nonprofit.
You kind of like a professor, in a sense.
This semester, yeah.
Yeah, you like it?
Yeah, it's fun. It is. I'm not really an educator, you know, like it doesn't come natural to me. I just sort of talk and hopefully they get something out of it.
Right. Ryan Gravel. Now I can say the visionary behind the Generator Workshop regarding Buford Highway.
Uh-huh. And Future Restaurant.
And Future Restaurant. Hey, Ryan, thanks for coming in and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Always great, Rose. Thanks a lot.
Support for WABE comes from WellStar Kennestone Hospital, which received Gold Seal Distinction for heart valve, coronary artery bypass surgery, and congestive heart failure. Kennestone is one of only two programs in the country to receive this distinction. WellStar.org. And from Morehouse Healthcare, the faculty practice of Morehouse School of Medicine, committed to serving all of your healthcare needs and dedicated to your total well-being. More information on services and locations at MorehouseHealthcare.com.
If you missed any part of today's show, we got you. You can catch up on all the interviews you missed at wabe.org/closerlook. And let me know what you think. Tweet me at WABE Rose Scott or send an email to rose@wabe.org. This is member supported 90.1 WABE Atlanta.
My name is Dawie Dolman. I live in Tucker. I actually just moved to Georgia because of family, girlfriend, and a better opportunity for job-wise. My first impression is there's a lot more stuff you can do besides, you know, just staying at home. It's a lot of activities, you know. I would describe Tucker, Georgia as, you know, it's a spot where it's very convenient, you know. It's away from the expensive apartments in downtown Atlanta. It's cheaper, and also it's right where it's not busy, where the traffic is hectic.
On the next Fresh Air, John Le Carré, who's written a new spy novel about the protege of Le Carré's most famous spy, George Smiley. Smiley was also in Le Carré's novels The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Le Carré was a spy before writing novels. He learned about deception from his father, who was a pathological liar. Join us this afternoon at 2 on 90.1 WABE.
Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the much-awaited decision regarding Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Programs, or DACA.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
In Georgia, more than 24,000 people have been approved for the DACA program to date. Under then-President Barack Obama, DACA was implemented on June 15, 2012. The program was temporary so that Congress could pass a more comprehensive immigration reform bill for undocumented children in the U.S. Last week, President Trump actually had this to say about Dreamers.
We love the Dreamers. We love everybody.
Well, now things are changing. Calling it an orderly wind down, what will happen in the next months to roughly 800,000 people known as Dreamers who entered the country illegally as children? Immigration attorney and immigration professor of Emory Law School, Charles Cook, joins me now, as always, Professor Cook.
Great to be back, Rose. Thanks for having me, especially today of all days.
Let me ask you what this day has been like for you.
Well, it's been heartbreaking. We represent thousands of Dreamers. We have five that work for us in our office, and I know what DACA means to them. It is hope. It's all about hope. It's about hope for a future. It's about hope for a life in a country they know and love. And to rip it away like this is immoral and unjust. And to base it on lies is even more outrageous.
When you say base it on lies,
well, this the first Jeff Sessions in his press conference, and I hate to call it a press conference, as he didn't take any questions, not technically a press conference, said one, that DACA was unconstitutional, and it's clearly not. He said that DACA kids take jobs from Americans, which they clearly don't. He said that DACA kids use Social Security, which is not true. He said that DACA itself has lent an air of lawlessness to America, which it is not. He said that DACA caused kids from Central America to come, which is not true. And there's a litany of things that he said that just are not based in any reality whatsoever. What DACA was, and what we know what DACA did for people, was literally change their lives. In Georgia alone, the 24,000 or so DACA recipients contribute more than $1 billion a year to the Georgia economy, these kids.
And where does that data come from?
That comes from the national centers in charge of this stuff. It's on my Facebook page.
Okay.
It's solid numbers. These numbers, you can't lie about them. The numbers are easy to look at. 91% of DACA kids are employed. 53% of them are actually in school still, or going back to school. And now what you tell the kids that would have been eligible for DACA that can no longer apply, forget about school. It's not important. Don't forget about your future. It's not important.
Let's get some facts out here. For those who were already approved under DACA, and for those 24,000 here in Georgia, what does today's decision mean?
It's a great question, because a lot of people think DACA ends today, and it does not. This is an announcement of the ending of DACA on March 5th, 2018. What they said was this: if you don't have DACA today, you cannot apply. If you had DACA in the past and it expired, you cannot apply. But if you currently have DACA and it expires sometime between now and March 5th, 2018, you can, by October 5th, submit a renewal of that DACA, and they will renew it for the full 2 years. Everybody else who expires after March 5th, your DACA will expire whenever your DACA expires. That could be, I had a call today on my way here, March 6th, or she expires. I'm sorry, you're out of luck.
And if someone's application was already in a, let's say, a holding pattern, so to speak, what does that mean?
They're going to adjudicate, approve or disapprove all pending applications according to current law. So if you filed by now, you're fine. You're going to get your DACA renewed so long as you're not ineligible, keeping in mind that the only thing that really makes you ineligible is a criminal conviction. That's why these kids aren't criminals in any way. So you will be okay. They'll extend you. But what they are no longer going to do is allow these kids to travel. They have had the ability to get what's called an advance parole. I know that sounds kind of weird in a non-immigration context. It's permission to travel before you leave. So you can go, my grandmother's sick. I have a school project to do, training abroad, or I've got a meeting to go to for my job. You can't go anymore.
Now you're talking about international travel?
International travel. Okay. International travel. You can travel in the United States, of course, but international travel is canceled. If you had a permission, it's good while it's valid, but all the ones currently pending are being denied.
Is there another, and I'm using the terms that are being used, is there another lawful immigration path that those who don't meet the criteria you just talked about that they could apply for?
No. I mean, that's the simple answer. Kids have DACA because there is no other way. A lot of Americans think, why don't they just go to the post office, you know, and get a green card? Why don't they just apply? There is no application for these kids. There is literally nothing under immigration law that would get them green card or permanent status in the United States, let alone citizenship at some distant future, which is perhaps the one empowering thing from today. I think the president just awakened a sleeping giant. 800,000 kids, some of whom were politically active before, but really a very small percentage, their families, their siblings who are U.S. citizens, their friends who are U.S. citizens, the parents of their friends are U.S. citizens. I think there will now be millions of people that will be calling our congressmen and representatives, asking them, what's your position on DACA? What's your position on the DREAM Act? What's your position on the Bridge Act? And literally calling Congress every day to put pressure on them. Maybe that's the one good thing that comes out of today.
The voice you hear is immigration attorney and Emory law professor, immigration law professor Charles Cook. You mentioned Congress because at this point, that is the only government body that could step in and change all of this.
That's correct. It's fully in Congress's hand. And, you know, Congress basically kicked the can down the road. Obama created, through his Homeland Security folks, the policy of DACA, which was nothing more than a deferral of removal. It wasn't legal status, which is another lie Jeff Sessions told today. It was just deferral of removal. We're not going to remove you if you come forward and tell us who you are. It was a way to weed out people that really weren't interested in deporting at this time. What happens now to these kids is something that really, I think, should break the heart of anybody with a soul. What are they going to do? Are they just going to walk away from their jobs? They're going to walk away from school? They're not leaving. They're not going out of the country anywhere.
You have folks who work in your law firm. What have they said? What will they do?
Well, that's a great question. Obviously, we can't employ them after that date because of U.S. immigration laws. They will find something else to do to survive here. But they're not going back because there's really nothing for them to go back to. They don't have another country.
And particularly for those that might have been brought here when they were toddlers or infants.
70% of the DACA kids came at 6 years old or younger. I mean, there is nothing for them to go back to.
President Trump and AG Jeff Sessions both called DACA a, quote, unlawful immigration policy. Now, under a constitutional lens, could today's decision be challenged, be successfully challenged?
Well, that's a great question, because I know that the Attorney General of New York and Washington State have both said they're going to challenge this decision by the president. It's not as easy as it may seem. The reality is it's the president's authority. That's why DACA was constitutional and is constitutional. Congress gave the president the power to enforce our immigration laws, and it's an unfettered power. All Obama did was simply structure the deportations in a different way. Said, okay, and he had authority to do that. He went through the APA rulemaking process. He did what he was supposed to do, which he didn't do for DAPA, which is why it's very different. Litigation is going to be tough on this issue. The president does, in fact, have authority to end the program and do it the way he pleases.
Let's talk about the difference between DACA and DAPA in terms of the actual policy.
Yeah, the DAPA was, of course, the Deferred Action for Parents of U.S. citizens and permanent residents that ultimately was struck down by the Fifth Circuit. It was struck down for a very specific reason. President Obama had not gone through the rulemaking process. He didn't say it was unconstitutional. They said he didn't go through the rulemaking process, which is something he did do for DACA ultimately. And that's the key difference here. I mean, the court was probably right about DAPA. That was a decision based upon its merits that was not incorrect. But it's wrong to say DAPA is like DACA. And in fact, DACA itself has already been challenged in the same circuit and found to be just fine.
Much like the travel ban, could this ultimately also end up with the nation's high court?
I don't think this is going to be at the high court. This is simply not an issue that's going to get that far. It doesn't have the structural integrity within itself to sustain an appeal to Supreme Court. No, we're going to find our relief here is amongst our representatives and senators in the U.S. Congress.
I want to talk about Jessica Collado because she's been a focus so much of, depending on whom you ask, what's right or what's wrong with the nation's immigration policies. Have you spoken to her?
I see her every day since she works for me. She's a remarkable young woman. Anybody who's met her would tell you the same thing. As much a victim of circumstances as anything else. She certainly didn't want the limelight thrust upon her. I can tell you that for sure. She is saddened by this, but understands the reality of our legislative and political system as well. And there's one thing I know about Jessica is she will fight within the bounds of the law as long as she can. And do what is right all that way through.
Implementation is one thing, execution is another, but come March 6th...
They're not going to start rounding kids up. That's not going to happen. I mean, can you imagine the outcry of the American people if literally they start going to houses and picking up, you know, 17-year-olds? It's just not going to happen. If you come to their attention after March 5th and you don't no longer have DACA, yeah, you drive without a license, you're going to be detained like anybody else. Mm-hmm. You no longer have that protection. But I don't see USCIS sharing this information with ICE as some sort of targeting mechanism. Frankly, most of the ICE officers I know wouldn't participate in such a thing.
And as far as I know, as far as I was to believe, ICE is concerned with picking up those who have criminal warrants or criminal
charges. Yeah, and those who hang around with them or those who happen to be in the same house when they pick them up, what they call low-hanging fruit. They do. They are really do focus on people that have criminal convictions, outstanding deportation orders. That's the other thing with DACA. Some of these kids have deportation orders because you could get DACA with a deportation order. These kids are subject to being picked up for that reason alone.
How many clients do you have, Attorney Cook?
We have several hundred DACA clients. I have friends, other immigration lawyers have thousands of DACA clients. In Georgia, most of them have lawyers. Most of them know that they have somebody there to fight for them. But most of them also know that at the end of the day, if they get put into deportation proceedings, they likely have no relief from deportation.
And I didn't want to put it like this, but at this point, there's nothing really you all can do for them, is there?
Other than raise our voices and demand that our Congress actually do something. You know, it's not just people that want to fix Obamacare that want Congress to do something. And immigration has been an issue that they have left to the side for years. DACA really let them kind of ignore the issue for the last 4 years. But I would guess if they don't pass, my estimation, if they don't pass some form of DREAM Act or Bridge Act before the next general election, there's going to be a lot of folks lose their seats.
As we wrap up, it's always easy to be the Monday morning quarterback. But looking back at when DACA was implemented, was there anything under the Obama administration that they could have done that would might have prevented where we are today?
Oh, absolutely. President Obama shouldn't have hired Rahm Emanuel. In 2008, because Rahm Emanuel came out in January 2009 and said, yeah, we'll deal with immigration in the second term instead of the first term. So when the president could have fixed all of this with a Congress that he could have gotten this through, he chose not to do it. And the reality is this is not a Republican-Democrat issue. You probably like to think it is, but it's really not. Both parties have used immigrants as a plaything, as a toy to rile their bases up or to get people to vote for them. And it's about time they act like grown-ups up in Congress and pass something that actually benefits America, something like the DREAM Act.
Immigration attorney and Emory Law School immigration professor Charles Cook, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
I appreciate it.
Support for WABE comes from the University of Georgia in Gwinnett. You can earn your graduate degree while working full-time. More about UGA's programs for working professionals at the Gwinnett Campus Open House on October 21st. Gwinnett.uga.edu.
The news can shift on a dime.
In his statement on Twitter, President Trump said that the military...
Senate rejected legislation to dismantle Obamacare by...
To date, Red Cross in Georgia has deployed 52 workers to Texas and Louisiana.
When it does, all things considered, reports what we know and we chase after what we don't. We take the time for another question to look ahead and get at what the news means right now. Stand with the facts. Listen every day from 4 to 6:30. It's All Things Considered here on 90.1 WABE.
You're listening to Closer Look. If you missed any of today's conversation, catch up on our website at wabe.org/closerlook. Again, wabe.org/closerlook. Also, we want to hear from you. Send our host, Rose Scott, an email at rose@wabe.org. This is 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.
My name is Hawa and I live in Claxton. One thing I like about Claxton is the diversity, and there's like many other people come from other countries. I have a lot of friends from different backgrounds. Like Claxton feel like to me is like an immigration center, like where some people from other countries and you get to meet friends and get to know other people from other nations. If I would change anything about Claxton, I would say like about the school where I go, like we have to have a new building and new stuff like this.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As president, Donald Trump has said he loves the so-called Dreamers, but now he's expected to keep a campaign promise he made as a candidate to end the DACA program.
I will immediately terminate President Obama's illegal executive order on immigration.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 3 on 90.1 WABE.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE. I'm Rose Scott. Residents near Grant Park have started a campaign to oppose the size of a proposed parking deck. That's because the city of Atlanta will have to cut down more than 131 historic trees to make room for it. Our own Tasneen Shama has more.
Grant Park is full of historic trees, but many near the main road have orange X's painted on them.
We're looking at a water oak at the corner of Boulevard and Confederate. It's beautiful, and it's a poster child of Grant Park.
That's Lee Finlayson. He lives across the street from where an underground parking deck is planned for 1,000 cars. Finlayson filed a tree conservation appeal with the city of Atlanta to save some of the trees. At an open house on Wednesday at the Grant Park Recreation Center, City of Atlanta arborist Chris Collio sympathized with the resident.
No getting around it. It's a lot of tree impact.
That's a lot of trees.
So,
we're doing
the best I can with getting stuff put back in the park.
The city plans to replace all of the tree canopy once the parking deck is built. But some neighbors say they're just glad the deck will have a green roof and was designed to blend in with the park.
There's no reason to save the trees on Boulevard.
That's Rick Hudson. He's the land use chair for the Grant Park Neighborhood Association. He says trees are already at risk because of nearby construction. He says those 1,000 parking spaces are needed to accommodate the planned expansion of Zoo Atlanta and a revamped cyclorama.
There's a number of considerations that bring other monies into our neighborhood that are depending on this project to move forward.
The city of Atlanta says it expects to start building the deck later this year. Tasneem Shama, WABE News.
And Closer Look continues now here on 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Rose Scott. In India, 30% of children live in what they say is extreme poverty. That's the highest in South Asia. And according to a 2016 report by World Bank Group and UNICEF, that's just about 385 million children living in extreme poverty. Since 1991, here in the U.S., the nonprofit VIBA has supported hundreds of projects in India, the focus creating a better life for the nation's underprivileged children. Now, here in Atlanta, Vijay Viamapalli serves as secretary and board of directors for VIBA Atlanta, and he joins me now. Welcome, Vijay.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin here because India is a large nation, and when we hear 30% of children live in extreme poverty, are there specific areas where this is more concentrated in?
It's across the nation, but there are pockets, particularly in the middle of India, as well as in the far eastern states, it's more concentrated. In the southern states, the situation is somewhat better.
Is this typically generational, that it continues for families, this extreme poverty?
Absolutely. And that is why we identify education as the single key that breaks this cycle of poverty. And education. That is where Vibha continues to focus. It is one of our main focus areas. Most of the projects that we fund in India are focused on education. It could be basic education. We work mostly with the government schools. In some cases, it is intervening in the government schools. In some cases, it is supplemental education. But education is really the key area that breaks this cycle of poverty.
And for so long now, we've seen the reports, read the numerous thousands of articles that talk about at such an early young age, many Indian children have to try and go and get work, you know, just to do whatever they can to help their family. So how do you go into a situation and explain that education is the key, but also that basic survival is needed for this family?
Exactly. In fact, one of the projects that we work, it touches upon what you just said. This is for the children of the construction workers. So these construction workers are migratory in nature. What happens is, when they are migratory, they go to a project, finish that project, go to another project. As a result, the children are not attending the schools. So one of the projects that we funded is called Doorstep School. If the children are not coming to the schools, then we take school to their doorsteps, and hence the doorstep school. So we identified this project to be solving the problem of children of migrant workers, and started investing it. What is interesting is, in this process, we identified that it is the builder that needs to be the stakeholder for this for the education of the children. So Vibha made sure that the builder actually pays for the school that is set up at the construction site. And the builders are actually happy, and now a good 40 to 50% of the budget is handled by the builders themselves.
How do you all as a nonprofit stay out of the political back and forth? And because someone listening might say, what you all are doing is great, but listen, can't the powers that be implement a law that says, look, no children under the age of 15 will be allowed to work anywhere, period.
Absolutely. In fact, we strongly believe that the government is the main stakeholder as far as the education and basic healthcare, nutrition of the children. And we work very hard in working with the government. In fact, one of our best projects I would like to touch upon is called Sikshana, which is intervening in the public school system. So we identified this as a scalable and replicable project because it is working with the government. The government is deploying a lot of resources in the school system. What was missing was motivational aspects for the children and the teachers. So this project addressed that. So Vibha identified these are the models that we need to support. And we, when we first supported this project in 2006, it was in 20 schools, and now we scaled it up, and it is now in 2,000 schools. And as we speak, actually, the state government has actually recognized this model, and now they are implementing it across the entire state.
And VIBA has a lot of affiliates here in North America. How do you all, what do you all do here? Let's say, for example, obviously, this is why you're here in the Atlanta area. What are you all doing to help?
And I can here I can speak for all the volunteers. We all have full-time jobs. and family responsibilities, but we all have free time that we want to put to good use. And that is where we come and do fundraisers. Whatever motivates each group of volunteers, they do fundraisers to spread the awareness and raise funds for these projects. But what that is one aspect of Vibha. Another aspect of Vibha is we put a lot of effort in identifying projects, scalable and replicable projects. So in that sense, we are becoming more and more like a social venture catalyst. Mm-hmm. We put in a lot of effort in identifying scalable and replicable models. And two of the projects that I talked about are identified to be scalable and replicable, and that is where we put most of our resources.
Anyone can be a volunteer and be a part of this, but I also take it that it's important, you all see it's important that also the Indian community, if they can, be a resource as well.
Absolutely, yes, anybody can be a volunteer. In fact, locally we have created a platform where anybody can volunteer. We encourage the local youth to go and volunteer locally. On an average, we at least do one local volunteering in places like Books for Africa, mm-hmm. Atlanta Food Bank, NFCC, North Fulton Charities. And these are the places that we encourage our youth to volunteer, and anybody who is interested can join as youth, as families. And so we are very big into volunteering as it is. Yes.
How do you, if you had a crystal ball, and you could envision what that poverty rate would look like that we talked about coming into the segment, let's say in 5 years, where would you like to see that percentage down to?
We have made a lot of progress in India, actually. Right now, if you talk about literacy rates, mm-hmm. it has caught up with the world average, which is about 90%. Mm-hmm. If you talk about...
Even for young girls?
It is actually, the rate is 15 to 24. That is called as the youth literacy rate,
okay.
which is right now in India is at about 89 point something, which is close to 90%, which is the world average. In terms of accessibility, education also is actually very high at about 97%. 99% of the children have access to education. What is missing is the quality. Mm-hmm. in the schools. And that is where a lot of effort is now being put by NGOs, non-government organizations mm-hmm. in India, as well as, in fact, a recognition also is coming from the government that they need to work with the NGOs to make the best difference in all these numbers. So, yes, a significant progress is being made.
And within that, there's significant progress for young girls to have access to reading and education as well?
There is still disparity
between
boys and girls. There is disparity between rural and urban. There is disparity between boys and girls. And when you look at the numbers, there is still a good 10 to 15% disparity between boys and girls in all these rates. However, the difference is shrinking quite fast. So there are a number of projects that are, even the government is specifically focusing on girl child. The nonprofit sector is also mm-hmm. focusing on the girl child. So with all this effort, the gap is shrinking, and that is quite encouraging.
And how often, Vijay, do you get to travel to India and see, you know, the benefits of the programs that you all are doing?
Whenever we go to India for our annual or, you know, once in 2 years vacation, myself, all of our senior volunteers, whenever we go to, we actually allocate some of our time to visit these projects and see how difference is being made mm-hmm. on the ground. And quite often we get energized by what we see and how all our effort here is being put to good use and, you know, how it is making a true difference.
But there's still a lot more to be done. So what's at the top of your list now in terms of what Vibha Atlanta is working on?
Education, education, education.
Education, education.
And then we are actually now beginning to look at job readiness, you know. While they are getting educated, the dropout rates are decreasing. Children are staying in schools. And they are getting, you know, the 10th grade or 11th grade, 12th grade, they are getting out. But what next? Some of them are going to higher education, but a lot of them need to get into a job. And there is particularly in urban areas, there is a lot of demand now. What is missing is that the soft skills that are required mm-hmm. for them to get ready to take up those jobs. And that is our new focus area, to make them get ready for the jobs.
And are there regions in India that you're still just having trouble penetrating and getting some of those projects to?
There are challenges, yes. There are some states where the nonprofit sector has matured mm-hmm. quite well. We get a number of good projects. But interior, some of the states, we still have challenges to identify good scalable projects and even efficient projects. A lot of them do good work, but in order to identify efficient scalable projects, sometimes it gets difficult. But the nonprofit sector in India is maturing quite fast. In my experience in the last 20 years, I have seen this maturity grow, and things are looking very good in that sense.
Why do you do this work?
Why do I do this?
Yeah.
I think, again, I think I can speak for all the volunteers and possibly for everybody. You know, all of us want to make a difference. You know, there is a part in all of us who want to make a difference, to use the resources that we have. It could be the money or the expertise, and in most cases, the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Vibha has created is a platform for all these people who want to do something. And on the other hand, you have the projects that need the resources. So Vibha, in that sense, has become the link between people who want to help and people and the organizations on the ground that need the resources.
And this organization, the national organization, was actually started in 1991, and the affiliates you all have grown around the nation.
Yes, yeah. I joined the organization in 93, and these were the early stages of internet, and I got connected with West Coast and East Coast volunteers, and we formed a network. And when I moved to Atlanta in 95,
mm-hmm.
we started the Atlanta Action Center, and it has become one of the biggest action centers, and we have a lot of passionate volunteers.
I know you have one here filming us right now.
Yes.
Where's your homeland?
Sorry?
Where's your homeland in India?
In the southern state of Andhra Pradesh.
And tell me about that place. What's it like?
It's a beautiful place. We have a rich culture. A number of states in India have diverse cultures. And Andhra Pradesh is a vibrant state. A lot of software engineers in Atlanta, mm-hmm. in Atlanta and elsewhere in USA come from my state, and a very vibrant community.
There's a smile on your face when you talk about it.
Yes.
Vijay Veeramapalli, he serves as a secretary and board of directors for Vibha Atlanta. Thank you so much for coming in and sharing what your organization is doing for the children of India.
Thanks for having us.
We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Salman Rushdie has set his novels all over the world. For his latest, he wanted to tell a story about his adopted home, the United States.
The subject of reinvention of the self is completely central. People come through Ellis Island and change their names. People move from the Midwest to the big city.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We talk with Salman Rushdie about his new book, The Golden House, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on 90.1 WABE.
That's it for today's edition of Closer Look, which is produced by Candace Wheeler, Ebony Lemon, and Finley Foxen. Our engineer is Elizabeth Eads. Our executive producer, Christine Dempsey. A special thanks to the entire WAB News team, as well as our digital services crew. If you missed any of today's show, you can find the entire program online at wabe.org/closerlook. You can now listen to Closer Look weeknights at 9 p.m. We're back tomorrow at 1 for another edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.